for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama removed the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, Stanley McChrystal, after the general made controversial remarks to a reporter. He was replaced by General David Petraeus. In Pakistan, five Muslim men from Northern Virginia were convicted of terrorism charges. China agreed to allow greater flexibility in its exchange rate, and the U.S. soccer team advanced in the World Cup after a last-second victory over Algeria. Joining me in the studio to talk about the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Elise Labatt of CNN, and Kevin Whitelaw of Congressional Quarterly. And, of course, you're always welcome during the program with your calls, your comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
Kevin Whitelaw, does replacing General McChrystal change anything in Afghanistan?
Well, in theory, no. Here's a general who's been overseeing the war strategy from his position at Central Command. So he was McChrystal's boss. So on some level, it shouldn't change the grand strategy, but there's no way that something like this, you know, won't change at the margins. Petraeus is going to come in. He's going to have some of his own ideas, and he's going to probably sort of make some incremental changes. There have been some criticisms, for instance, of whether McChrystal might have been a little too cautious in allowing the troops to go after going out on counterterrorism missions. He was maybe a little too concerned about the civilian casualty question. That's been the criticism from troops. So that's one place people will be looking to see if maybe he sort of ratchets up the operational tempo a little bit.
What about General Petraeus' relationship to President Karzai? Elise.
Well, General McChrystal had a very good relationship with Karzai, and even Karzai himself had said, you know, President Obama had called him to tell him what was happening. President Karzai said, look, I really hope you don't do that. In the end, when they did announce General Petraeus, you know, Karzai has a decent relationship with him, certainly not as good as McChrystal, but said that he supported the choice. But this is really the crux of what's going on in Afghanistan. I mean, I think what this has done is sharpened the fears that the mission is floundering. What are we doing in Afghanistan? There's not a lot of good news there. June is not even over, and it's already the highest month of casualties in the war. You've had more than 80 American casualties. And I think that this is really sharpening fears about what's going on. So now the whole crux of this is the Afghan government a reliable partner? Afghanistan has been seen to be hedging its bets. You saw these leaked cables by Ambassador Eikenberry that were the whole, a lot of those comments in the Rolling Stone article about McChrystal's feelings about Eikenberry. And now I think everyone's going to be thinking about whether this mission, can we win it? Is it possible? And what do we do about Karzai?
Moises.
I completely agree with that. I think that's a very accurate depiction. The other way, or the complementary way of saying this, is not only the United States thinking if Karzai is an adequate ally, is about the Karzai thinking if are the Americans a good ally. The Pakistanis are thinking, can we trust the Americans to stay the course and hold it? When they leave, you know, we're going to get stuck with the remainders and whatever happens here. The other thing is that the change in military leadership that happened this week is going to increase pressures to changes in the civilian leadership. We know that there is a lot of tensions, frictions, even some people call it dysfunctionality in the team. We know that Dick Holbrooke, which is a special envoy to the region, is a source of a lot of tensions and frictions with
Why?
Others. Apparently, he is not in excellent working terms with Ann Patterson, the ambassador to Pakistan. He's not in good terms with the military. He's not in good terms with Carl Eikenberry, the ambassador in.
So there is a, you know,
you could say that the American team is as dysfunctional from the perspective of others, is as dysfunctional, and they have as many and as valid criticism in a variety of ways as the Americans have of the Pakistani and Afghan governments.
Will Petraeus be able to unify the Obama officials behind the administration strategy?
Well, it's exactly one of his many tasks when he goes in there. And the good news here is that General Petraeus is probably one of the most capable diplomats among the uniformed military officers that, you know, in a generation. I mean, he's famous for his skills as a politician and as a diplomat, if you like, in addition to his military strategic mind. So,
except isn't there a question about General Petraeus' relationship with Vice President Biden?
Well, there are some questions about whether they have differed at the strategy at various points. That's going to be a debate all throughout. And you know, President Obama has always said he wants debate inside his cabinet and his advisors, but obviously a unified policy. So the trick is going to be, can they all come together and agree and then carry it out? I think one of the things that article revealed were some of the shortcomings that General McChrystal had when it came to dealing with the non-military parts of the mission there, dealing with the civilians side, working with others, working with allies in particular, which is becoming an increasingly problematic place, given that we're starting to see a lot of NATO allies peel off and say that they're going to pull out of the Afghan mission. It's going to be extra important for someone like Petraeus to try to be able to reach out to them, to be able to reach out to the Afghans, be able to reach out to the civilians, and indeed reach out to the White House.
And I mean, President Obama pretty much acknowledged that there's a lot of infighting going on within his team when he said, I will tolerate debate, I will not tolerate division. And what this article really illuminated is that there's a lot of infighting in this administration over where to go, how to fight this war, what the mission is really all about. As Kevin said, General Petraeus is very good about building coalitions, building teams. We see what he did with Iraq, with Ryan Crocker, the two of them hand in hand, really reaching out, going out to the Sunnis. You had that whole Sunni awakening that General Petraeus really orchestrated himself. But I think one of the problems is Iraq is not Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Okay? And not only is Iraq not Afghanistan in terms of the terrain and in terms of the enemy, but it's also not the same in terms of the political landscape among the people on the team and in Washington. I mean, General Petraeus really, in President Bush, had someone who was willing to take risks, who this mission in Iraq was, you know, very important to him. You see President Obama, you know, yes, the mission is very important to the U.S., but he wants to get out, and it's unclear whether he's going to back Petraeus. He might want to extend the deadline in 2011, and President Obama has made clear that he wants to get out.
It may be too much to ask of General Petraeus to be the unifier of all the civilian leadership and all the allies and all the moving parts that are involved in this. This is a job that transcends the military commander. This is a job for the President of the United States. First. Second, those divisions are not just personalities and frictions and turf. These are the deep disagreements. What is the mission? What is the definition of victory? What is the definition of progress? How do you measure it? How do you relate to Karzai? What is your vision for the future of the Pakistani-Afghan-Indian relationship? And finally, is this winnable? Lingering and the undercurrent of these things is deep, deep anxiety, both on the part of Democrats, of Republicans, of the media, of the military, about, you know, what is at the end the outcome of all this.
And isn't that the basic difference between General Petraeus and Vice President Biden, that the Vice President wanted a much lighter footprint.
The debate here is between counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. The original mission in Afghanistan was to make sure that al-Qaeda was not operating there, deny them a safe haven and the ability to operate internationally from there. That was counterterrorism. That was stopping the terrorists. That then evolved into counterinsurgency because the counterterrorism, al-Qaeda was not the most important player, is not today the most important player in Afghanistan, is the Taliban. And that is a different kind of war, is counterinsurgency. That's where General Petraeus, who wrote the manual, and that involves winning hearts and minds. It involves economic development. It involves building a government. It involves nation building in a state, in a country that did not have a nation. So the story here is a deep anxiety about what is the mission, what is the nature of what is achievable. And if you look at what the way in which President Obama has been shaving down the ambitions, he's no longer talking about victory. He's no longer talking about, initially there was some talk about bringing democracy to Afghanistan. Now he's very modest and he tries to be very careful in the way he talks about what is the victory definition there.
This counterinsurgency strategy called COIN is what it's popularly called. And as Moise said, General Petraeus wrote it. The manual, one of the primary lines that I think this article illustrates that the strategy is not working is unity of effort. If one part of the mission fails, all parts of the mission fail. So that's why it's going to be so important. You not only have a clash of personalities, you have a clash of cultures between what the military is trying to do and what the civilian is trying to do.
Elise Labbitt, Chief Senior State Department Producer for CNN. We'll take a short break. We'll be talking about China's currency when we come back, the UK, how it's cutting back on its own budget, more after a break. And more on General McChrystal. Here's an email from Christine. General, does General McChrystal's resignation mean he's resigning from the military or only from his post in Afghanistan?
I think we really don't know. I mean, there's been some talk about him retiring from the military. He was a 3-star before he took this job. And I think you have to be, I'm not really quite clear on the rules, but my understanding is that you have to be in the position as a 4-star for a certain amount of time before you can retire as a 4-star. So it's really unclear. Is he going to be able to retire as a 4-star general and keep that legacy with him? I mean, President Obama, you saw in his announcement, did try to allow him some sort of dignity about his career. So it really remains to be seen. But I don't think we're going to be seeing General McChrystal in the military anymore.
And Kevin, you said that there is really a bigger, more important issue here.
Well, you know, there are several bigger issues here, but I'm sorry, I guess I forget where you wanted me to
take
this.
All right, go ahead, Moises.
Yeah, the larger issue is that there is lots of rumors and indications that the Pakistanis, the Pakistani army, the Pakistani government, and the Pakistani intelligence services are dealing with the Taliban, especially with the Haqqani network, which is a very powerful, very large group of insurgents, and they are trying to get a deal with them. And again, this is also amplified by the anxiety over the possibility that the Americans will leave and the Pakistani nation and the Pakistani military will have to deal with what's left.
And there's some feeling as the U.S. wants to draw this down. We've talked before about what is victory. We're not talking about the grand victory, success, and democracy that we were, that in the hopes of getting out, that the U.S. might come around to this idea. And, you know, we saw what General Petraeus did with Iraq, with the Sunni awakening. He's expected to shake it up a little bit. And it remains to be seen, maybe not the senior leaders of the Haqqani network or the senior, obviously not al-Qaeda, but, you know, as the Afghans work forward towards political integration, there's been a lot of debate about reconciliation of the top Taliban leaders. If you have the Afghans on board, if you have the Pakistanis on board, and this seems to think that the U.S. could maybe get out sooner rather than later, it remains to be seen whether the U.S. is going to go along with it.
So I guess, you know, the real question here becomes, you know, is this going to be an opportunity for the Obama administration to come together, to take all these different pieces, to say, all right, we now have this opportunity, some of the problems and splits in our strategy, some of the places that we're not making progress in have been revealed in an undeniable way. Does Petraeus have this opportunity to go in and try to pick all the pieces together, reshape things, and try to make some progress?
It's a bit of a deja vu with Iraq, so we have to see if he can pull a rabbit out of
a
hat again.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about China's announcement that it's going to allow some flexibility in its currency. We really haven't seen it yet, though, Moises.
This can be either the biggest economic story of the year or just playing games and just pretend that they're doing it before the meeting of the Group of 20, the group of countries that is meeting this weekend in Toronto, Canada. This has been a long story, starting with Bush, even with Clinton, the notion that the Chinese have an exchange rate that helps greatly their exports and creates a big barrier to imports. And I remember that they were called currency manipulators, that the United States have tried and others have tried very hard to make them make their currency a little bit more expensive, so that will allow them to compete in a more even field in the international markets. So they announced, and this was a major announcement over the weekend, that they would allow the currency to move. It has moved a whole lot of 0.39%, which is nothing. So the question is, are they serious? Will they really allow this thing to move and reach a different level? We need to remember that by now, China also has a very powerful export lobby. The Chinese export companies also are very powerful, and they don't want this. And so it remains to be seen if this, again, as I said, is it the biggest economic story of the year or the biggest trick of the year?
Well, the Chinese have said that they're going to do this, but it has to be, and the foreign ministry had said, gradual and controllable. So what they did was they had this kind of reference rate that the yen shouldn't go too far against this rate. We've seen, as Moises said, some fluctuations. And they also were trying to head off legislation in Congress that would tax duties on Chinese imports. You know, the Congress is concerned that this is hurting U.S. manufacturers, resulting in losses at home. So they don't. Chinese also don't want to be seen as bowing to international pressure, bowing to U.S. pressure. So I think we're going to see this happen very slowly and gradually. You know, as the world economy continues to improve, you might see it. But President Obama just said yesterday, we need to see more.
Well, and you know, the Obama administration's tried to play this one carefully because it's something they talked about a lot earlier, and then they sort of went radio silent on it for a few months, dialed down the rhetoric, and the idea was give the Chinese government some space so that they could be seen to be doing it on their own rather than responding to U.S. pressure. And at least, you know, rhetorically, there's been obviously this development. But to the degree that you know, if the U.S. comes out and says, hey, we need more, then that actually could produce a bit of a backlash and a retrenching.
Is there going to be a lot of talk about this at the G20?
It's not in the formal agenda, but it's certainly a major issue because this is not only a matter for the United States. It's very important for Europe. It's very important for other Asian countries. It is. I want to note, however, that even though at this point this has been just an announcement, it's a very important announcement. And so the Obama administration can take credit for changing China's ways, both with Iran, in terms of accepting. China has accepted to support sanctions on Iran, which is something that the United States wanted. And it was a surprise that they can pull it off and that the U.S. government persuaded the Chinese to go along. And now this. So even if it's just rhetorical, it's a very important achievement in many ways.
All right, let's talk about Great Britain and the new prime minister taking some very, very serious steps that the Parliament was not too happy about, Kevin.
Well, no, I mean, it's the new government has really introduced an incredibly austere budget that's a mix of tax hikes and really, really steep budget cuts and is really going to produce a lot of pain and turmoil but it's, you know, an attempt, obviously, to try to avoid in England what's happened in other parts of Europe, Greece and elsewhere with runaway deficits. So we're looking at an increase in the luxury tax. We're looking at a couple other tax increases and then some really, really steep budget cuts. They protected the defense and the health service from the worst of the cuts, but some other departments were cut by up to a third. So
how much courage did it take for this new prime minister to move in this direction?
The courage of the inevitable. Any government would have had to do this, and there are things. No government likes to cut 25% of the budgets. No government wants to freeze all wage increases in the public sector. No government wants to do these things. But so governments are forced to do it when they have no option. This, however, illustrates a very important debate that is going on today in the global economy between those that are cutting the budgets and those that think that it's too early and too soon and too much. President Obama sent a letter recently to the leaders of the Group of 20 saying that, especially he explicitly said, cutting too much too soon could lead to renewed hardships and recession. This notion is that just a few months ago, all these governments were told spend in order to stimulate the economy and go all out and try to boost and try to avoid a recession or a second, what they call a double dip.
Right.
Which is after there is a recession, it goes up and then it goes down again. So to avoid that, spend. Now, just a few months later, they're being told cut and stop spending. So that's part of the big debate that is going to take place in Toronto at the Group of 20. That is the essence of, and the reality is that these are very different countries. So some countries can allow, Germany, for example, it can't spend more and it's not spending more. And others like Spain and Italy and Greece have to cut. So the notion that you have just one universal
approach
for countries that are very different and that are suffering the crisis in different ways is what we're going to see discussed here.
During his election campaign, Prime Minister Cameron made cutting the deficit a top priority. He was preparing the public. The public, you know, elected him based on these campaign pledges to really get the economy in shape. And he basically said to the public that these cuts are going to be felt for years, maybe decades. And, you know, the British have this kind of reputation as, you know, being austere and willing to, scrimp and save. And so this is what he's asking them to do again. But Moises is right. There is a sharp debate, particularly between the U.S. and Europe, about how much to cut. The U.S., it's ironic that, you know, over a year ago when the Obama administration took over, the rest of the world was criticizing them for their economic policies and for causing this world economic crisis. Now that the U.S. is in a stronger position, it's saying, you know, the way we got out of this was with this stimulus package. You can too. Treasury Secretary Geithner traveled to Europe really looking for these stimulus packages. And I think it's going to be the sharpest issue at the G20.
But at the same time, the Fed statement this week was a little on the weak side, Kevin.
Well, the economy, the U.S. economy is still in a tough place.
Very fragile.
And the international economy has not boosted it as much as people would think. And these clouds on the European economy in particular are really a problem. The exports are going to be one way that the U.S. can grow its way out of this thing. And to the degree that those markets are not going to be able to support a lot of demand, these kind of cuts will make that problem worse.
All right. Let's talk about these five Muslim men from Northern Virginia, convicted in Pakistan on terrorism charges. Remind us of what they did, Kevin.
Well, these were five men who traveled to Pakistan with the apparent intention of heading into Afghanistan, and they were picked up by the Pakistani authorities and accused by Pakistan of going there to try to fight with the Taliban and to join up with that movement, or possibly even Al Qaeda. There was always a little bit of lack of clarity about exactly what. And it was interesting. For a while, the U.S. authorities were very quiet on this because it was clear that they didn't quite know how to react. And in fact, I think right away, they might have thought that the Pakistanis were overreacting on this one. But I think over time, it's become a little clearer that there might well have been something of concern going on here.
Actually, what happened was this CARE, this Muslim American organization, the families had gone to this organization and said, these guys are missing. They left behind these video kind of saying that Muslims need to be defended. They put the families in touch with the FBI, who contacted the Pakistanis. So it did seem to be that there was something going on. It was unclear, but these guys were looking to make connections. It wasn't clear whether they made the connections. They talked to some people who had extremist ties, but they were definitely looking to make some mischief. And this is just part of a larger issue that you've seen this week. The verdict came down about Pakistani magnate Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber. U.S. very concerned about Americans going to Pakistan and Afghanistan for training.
Elise Labatt, CNN. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Moises, I know you want to add to that.
This is also a story about identity, the internet, and the radicalization of Americans of Muslim origins that become radicalized, young Americans. We have seen now several that become, through the internet and through other channels, getting involved and radicalized and traveled. We saw the example of the Somali youngsters out of Buffalo, New York, that went to Somalia and elsewhere to join Al-Qaeda. So the internet is playing a role, but there's also a story about identity, about young Americans that are born and bred and go to American high schools and are part of this society, but then they become radicalized and decide join terrorist groups. These youngsters from Northern Virginia went to Pakistan. They went in Hyderabad. They met with Jaish-e-Muhammad, which is a terrorist-linked organization. So the bottom line is that Al-Qaeda and radical terrorists are not just in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Somalia. They are in some cities in the United States.
And the question becomes, will they also be charged in U.S. courts, or will they simply stay in prison in Pakistan, Kevin?
That's right. We don't know the answer to that yet. Nothing's been filed against them in U.S. court, but obviously it's something that the U.S. authorities will be looking at, particularly to the degree that these guys, you know, appear to face some time in prison, but not necessarily life. So it's going to be that will be an interesting decision down the line, in part because it's not clear what evidence they'll be able to muster against them, particularly given questions about, whether the Pakistani authorities and whatever information they glean
have
is even
evidence.
Admissible
yeah.
in court.
Yeah. And 10 years for each of them, are the sentences appealable? Do we know?
They are going to appeal. They're on appeal right now. This trial went through much quicker than a lot of trials in Pakistan that drag on. So far, U.S. officials that I've talked to said they don't see any, injustice here, any unfair trial that might make the appeal a no-brainer. But they said that they don't. The U.S. really doesn't want to comment pending the appeal, but they are entitled to appeal, and it looks like they're going to exercise it.
One pattern what we have seen in these recent failed attempts is a lot of rage, but not a lot of knowledge and not a lot of skills. Faisal Shahaz, which is the Times Square would-be bomber with a car bomb, you know, when you read the story, the way he manages was very clumsy. Very, you know, again, lots of rage, but not lots of skill. We have seen a pattern of that. And that, the scary part about this is that one day we will have both the rage, the skill, the training, and the success of an attack.
Well, Moises is right. And what makes this really interesting still is the importance of the personal contact here, because we've seen this, you know, the internet is a radicalization tool with terrorists. It clearly can serve as a networking tool, but the most capable terrorists are always the ones that have had the most hands-on training. And so even though some of these you know, maybe more inept recent terrorists have had a certain amount of hands-on training, the ones who get more and more training are the ones who are more and more dangerous. That still gets back to where we started from. If you remember, with the Afghan, you know, conflict, it was to go in and root out the terrorist camps where they had planned, you know, the 9/11 attacks. And so it is still having a base of operations somewhere in the world where they can congregate and give this kind of training in person. It is still at the heart of what makes al-Qaeda, you know, very dangerous.
Kevin Whitelaw, Congressional Quarterly, Moises Naim. He's chief international columnist for Al País. Elise Lappett is Senior State Department Producer for CNN. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones, read your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Over 20 years after a car accident left psychologist Dan Gottlieb with quadriplegia, his young grandson Sam was diagnosed with autism. Gottlieb started writing down his thoughts about what it's like to be different in a series of letters to his grandson. They were published in a popular book. He's just published a follow-up. Dan Gottlieb on the next Fresh Air.
And now it's time to open the phones for your calls. Let's go first to Newington, Connecticut. Good morning, Hirsch. You're on the air. Hirsch, are you there? All right, let's try Thomas in Dallas, Texas.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I was going to ask your panelists with regard to the current U.S. policy in Afghanistan. What would be the justification for the Obama administration for not taking advantage of the resignation of General McChrystal to just withdraw as many troops as possible, given the circumstances and the geopolitics of that region, especially the situation in Pakistan, the situation in Iran, and all the neighboring, and also the history of the Afghan tribal geopolitical situations.
Moises.
Well, there is a lot of people that think that way. There is a lot of people that think that the United States should just leave. It will be a, probably a mistake to leave on the basis of a newspaper magazine article. You would expect that a strategy of that, a decision of that magnitude will be more reasoned and there will be a better plan. And by the way, the United States is committed to start drawing down troops in a year from now. The president said... That saying that in a year it was beginning the process didn't say anything about the pace and the scale of the drawing down. So, but the United States is on a path to reduce its presence in Afghanistan.
All right. And let's go now to Margate, Florida. Good morning, Henry. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a simple question. Did George Bush not ask his generals where we will be getting out of his stupid wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Or did the generals not ask him, sir, when will we be getting out of these wars that you are starting? Because it seems to me that Republicans find it okay for us to be spending untold millions and billions on these wars, but it's not okay with them for us to spend on our poor people in this country.
Lots of folks have raised those kinds of issues.
Well, Henry raises an issue that's felt about a lot of Americans around the world. How much money we're spending on wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan. We look at the world economy. A lot of the U.S. economy is in the toilet, and we're continuing to spend on these wars. However, you know, both President Bush and President Obama spent many weeks and months talking with the generals about how to win the strategy in Iraq, in Afghanistan. The problem is that these wars, you know, may not be winnable. The U.S. can leave the situation in a better place than it found it, but maybe not win. And I think in Afghanistan, you're going to see a more realignment of what is possible in Afghanistan. But certainly, I don't think that the president makes these decisions lightly without consulting with his military advisors.
All right. To Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, Rush. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning to you. I wanted to respond to Moise's comment earlier that even if China's announcement that it was going to let its currency fluctuate a little bit was just rhetorical, it was important. Well, I would definitely underscore the term rhetorical. You know, first of all, there's a consensus among economists that China for years has kept its currency artificially lower by about 20% to 40%, and all they're talking about, and so far they're just talking about, is letting it rise maybe a couple of percentage points over the years. And I think it's mostly just gamesmanship by the Chinese to take off the pressure that had been building against them before the G20 meeting. And it's not just the currency. You know, they do all kinds of rampant protectionist policies for years. That, you know, reduce our ability to export to them while they rack up enormous trade balances. They've been accused by our software associations of rampant intellectual theft. And, you know, this really, according to, you know, some economists, has cost us millions of jobs over the years. And I think their declaration, you know, they're going to let the RMB fluctuate a little bit, is like saying, well, then, you know, rather than stealing from all rooms of our house, they're going to stop stealing from our hall from now on.
All right. Moises.
There is a lot of what Raj says that is true, especially intellectual property. You know, the counterfeit industry in China in a lot of industries is huge and undermines other industries. So there's a lot of what he says that it's true. But what we don't know yet, and he doesn't know and I don't know, if this announcement by China is going to be real or not. And he's maybe right in saying that this is just games, you know, he's just playing games.
And speaking of games, one of our listeners, Denise, said It would be a wonderful diversion to hear about the tennis match. A little breath between the serious stuff. How many watched for how many hours?
It was over 3 days, about 11 hours. Broke all the records, longest match, longest number of games, longest set. And during this match, if you look at what happened, U.S. and England played their World Cup matches. You know, many of the Wimbledon players went on to the second round. President Obama addressed the McChrystal affair, and this all wasn't over. And you know, even one of the players had said, like, enough, enough. And the other one was like, go on, go on. And so finally, this is a match that has really beat all the legendary matches that they've had.
Although, you know, you can't help but feel for the American player who goes through this. He wins and then he's knocked out in the next game. So, you know, it's all that effort to win.
He's
still
part of history.
One of the most historic matches at Wimbledon, and he's thrown out in the next game in a very, very, very short match.
All right, and what about the World Cup? What about that, Moise?
Huge surprises. The big surprise is the big teams, Italy, France, that big players, superpowers are out. And the United States, that did not exist for many years and did not win since 1930, is advancing. The other big surprise is that Americans are paying attention. This is a game and a sport that is beginning to be important in the United States, but doesn't reach to the level of football or basketball.
But, you know, young kids are playing soccer.
Yeah, but now what you see is millions of people just stopping in the middle of the week and middle of just to watch a game, and that is unprecedented.
Going to bars.
And also the New York Stock Exchange, apparently on Wall Street, you know, the traders in between trading were, like, watching, you know, at the bullpen at the State Department, all the journalists, no one was working. There was so much screaming. But I think that this team really embodies the American spirit of never give up. The match with England, they lost their goal in the first 4 minutes and then went on to a draw. In Slovenia, they were down 2 goals at halftime and then they went on to a draw. And this, you know, final goal by Landon Donovan in the last few seconds of the game, I think that's also one of the reasons why, you know, Americans are so passionate about this team. And even President Clinton was there. He was watching. He went into the locker room telling them how proud their country is of them. And I think Americans, with all the sad news that we've talked about on this show and in the previous hour, it's good to have something that Americans can, you know, be happy about and talk about at the water cooler and be proud of.
It's actually a nice moment too for the United States, because it's the U.S. team's actually won a lot of fans with its play. I mean, fans around the world too. You really have a lot of international support for this team, which is a little unusual to have foreigners cheering for an American team in anything. But the story, the excitement, the sheer just gamesmanship of the matches have really won over a lot of people.
And the earlier match when a call went against the U.S. and lost the game in that way.
The United States has been the victim of two bad calls from referees in this World Cup that has gained a lot of goodwill to the American team from fans around the world. It has two goals that were disallowed by the referees, and then upon watching it on video, it was discovered that they were bad calls against the United States. Together with what Kevin was saying about how well this team is playing and how it is taking on the Giants and doing well, is the first, again, as I said, the first time in 80 years that is advancing on its group. Plus the disallowed goals, gaining a lot of goodwill, that can do more for American diplomacy and American standing in the world than winning a lot of wars around the world.
All right, back to business here. Jeff in Alexandria says, do you have any idea if the Obama administration is considering a role for former Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad in the future Afghan strategy?
Well, there's been some talk about this, and you know that, you know, Zal Khalilzad really plays both sides of the fence, because for this last Afghan election, he was setting up a political action committee to run for president of Afghanistan. So clearly he, you know, was part of the, you know, first Jirga, the bond process all those years ago. And he definitely knows the players. you know, he's kind of an unofficial, not advisor, but definitely people in the administration are consulting him all the time. I'm sure he'd love to play such a role. I don't know if that's really in the cards. It's certainly, I wouldn't be surprised to hear something like that. He is very tied to the Bush administration, but he definitely does know a lot about Afghanistan and knows all the players.
Kevin.
Well, and certainly General Petraeus worked with Khalilzad in several incarnations, so there'd be a relationship there of sorts. But President Obama said that the crystal change was you know, the only change he's making for now, and that his team is going to stay intact. We'll see as it goes down. Petraeus is going to have a lot of leverage to choose who he wants to work with, and to the degree that he decides that any of the current advisors are a problem or an obstacle, he's going to have a lot of power to be able to go to the president and say he wants a change.
Here's an email from Douglas, who says the replacement of General McChrystal with General Petraeus brings up many questions. Technically, this is a demotion for General Petraeus. He was Commander-in-Chief of Central Command. General McChrystal worked for him. Is General Petraeus going to continue as Commander-in-Chief of Central Command? The answer is no. They brought in a British.
No, they haven't brought in anybody yet.
Nick Parker is taking over the British command. The commander of British forces is, and his and McChrystal's deputy is taking over as commander until Petraeus is confirmed. Petraeus has said, and the U.S. White House has said that no, he won't take over as he won't continue his job as CENTCOM commander. But you know, he really didn't have a choice. When the president says we need you to serve, he really had no choice but to do it.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Doug goes on to say, I found it curious that General McChrystal went to see the president by himself and not with his two immediate supervisors, General Petraeus and Secretary Gates. In fact, normally it would have been the Secretary of Defense who did the firing. Isn't that how it happened? We didn't hear from the president for 2 hours after General McChrystal left the White House, Moises.
That's a very good question, and one that has been a matter of great speculation, because where is the Secretary of Defense in all this and so on? Let's remember that Secretary Gates was a big supporter of General McChrystal. He was a big factor in his appointment. And but at the end of the day, I don't think it matters anymore. At the end of the day, we saw what happened. It was a very important situation, a very difficult situation that now the president has navigated without any major collateral damage. And, you know, the slogan and the mantra for this is, let's not miss a beat. Let's just have this transition get over with the situation and make sure that there is continuity in policy and that the rest of the world, our allies, our enemies, our troops, don't get confused by this transition.
Actually, McChrystal did meet with Gates first. Then he went to the White House to talk to the president. He did kind of go up. You know, Gates is the immediate person that he reports to, and then went and talked to the president. And then the president met with the full national security team. So he kind of did go up the chain of command and apologized to everybody that he trashed in this article.
All right, Ray, who's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There was a comment made earlier about Chinese correcting its currency, or adjusting its currency, and basically nothing's been going on for, who knows, 20 years now, 10, 20 years. Now, the alternative to adjusting currency is to impose a tariff on Chinese goods in order to create a level playing field. And I'm surprised that has never been brought up on the table, because so many of our jobs have been lost, manufacturing jobs, R&D jobs to China, with no quid pro quo. I'd like to, you know, ask your comment on that.
Sure.
Well, I think that you know, that people have talked about, you know, there are some people who've advocated those kind of tariffs, but given how interdependent the world economy is, given how dependent the U.S. is on imports from China, the concern is that as soon as you go down that road, China retaliates with another set of penalties that could be very damaging to the United States, and you end up in a trade war where you're much worse off at the end of it than you were when you started.
Actually,
so,
some people think that China made the small fluctuations that it did to head off Congress taking these measures, really concerned about American manufacturers. And some people think that that's one of the reasons that they did this right now.
I think it's important to put in context the notion that China has been called a currency manipulator, taking away jobs from the United States, a protectionist, a trickster, and so on. But it's also important to know that China, in this crisis, has behaved as a very responsible stakeholder of the global economy. China, if you look at the way in which Chinese economic policies have performed and how the Chinese economic authorities have dealt with the crisis, in which they could have been tempted to go into a lot of very counterproductive measures, they didn't.
Such as?
Protectionism and controls. And there are a lot of things that they were tempted, could have done that they didn't. I'm not saying that there is not a lot of protectionism, but then who is not guilty there and around the world? I'm not saying that they're not playing with the currency. But in this China bashing, it's very important to remember that in the last couple of years, during the worst crisis that we have had, China was part of the solution, was not a part of the problem.
Moises Naim, he's chief international columnist for El País. Elise Labatt is senior State Department producer for CNN. Kevin Whitelaw, he's defense and foreign policy editor for Congressional Quarterly. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.